KPCW News Time is 8:06. Well, it looks like it might be a little wet this weekend. Let's find out just how wet. On the phone, I've got Thomas Guiboy with ABC4 Weather. How wet's it going to be, Thomas?
Well, today is going to be a pretty soggy day, Roger, and we're going to be looking at some pretty soggy conditions more or less through Saturday. Now, by the back half of the weekend, I'm optimistic that we'll be looking somewhat okay. But yesterday, we saw our first of a couple of storm systems move through. The second one is now in the process of arriving now, and we're already looking at scattered showers and even a few thunderstorms out there. And today, it's all but a certainty that wet weather will find you. I don't think it's going to be one of those days where it's just nonstop 100% of the time, but we could see multiple rounds of wet weather making it kind of feel like a washout. So there will likely be some breaks, but at any point today, no matter where you're at, across the Wasatch back or really across the entire state today, there will be a decent chance that wet weather finds you. For any outdoor plans, definitely keep your eyes to the sky. It will be cooler compared to what we've seen recently. Instead of a daytime high like we saw yesterday in the 50s, we'll mainly be in the upper 40s today in Park City while we sneak into the 50s down in the Heber Valley. So for most of what we find today in Park City, it is still going to be mainly rain showers with the snow line staying above 7,000 feet. And we do have a winter weather advisory for the southern Wasatch and for the western Uintas, but the bulk of the snow that we're going to see between today and tomorrow is mainly going to be above 8,000 feet. Now, as we go into tonight, we're going to hold on to a pretty good chance for showers, but with the overnight low dropping to 34 degrees in Park City, there is going to be a chance that we could see a wintry mix or even briefly times of snow. If we do see a straight changeover as we go from tonight into tomorrow morning, there is at least a possibility in Park City, given the elevation around 7,000 feet, that we could see some minor accumulations. It's by no means a guarantee, but that potential does exist. So that's one thing that you do want to keep in mind if you're out on the road, maybe later tonight into tomorrow morning. And then by tomorrow afternoon, we'll still be looking at a good chance for scattered showers. It just won't be as slam dunk of a chance compared to what we find today. So it's an 80% chance of rain and snow showers for our Saturday, a daytime high of 43. So even a little bit cooler than what we find this afternoon. Then by Saturday night into Sunday, our storm system will gradually begin to exit. However, some lingering moisture will be left behind. And on Sunday, roughly a 1 in 3 chance of seeing showers, mainly rain, but maybe some snow first thing in the morning with a daytime high that will eventually climb to 48 degrees. Then by Sunday night, partly cloudy sky, the overnight low drops to around freezing throughout the Wasatch back. Then as we move through the first half of next week, it's going to be looking and feeling like spring. Can't completely rule out a chance for an afternoon pop-up shower or even a rumble of thunder both Monday and Tuesday, with the daytime highs climbing back into the mid and upper 50s. Overnight lows hold steady in the low to mid 30s. And then by the middle of next week, I think we're right back into the 60s with the daytime high of 60 on Wednesday. And we should be right around 65 degrees on Thursday. So we're going down to the bottom of the Utah spring weather roller coaster. And we'll start to climb back as we round out the weekend and move into next week, Roger.
Thomas, when you talk about a roller coaster, yesterday afternoon, I think the temperature was in the 40s, and yet we saw some hail. What leads to that? And are we likely to see that again?
Well, it all just depends on the thunderstorms that we have themselves, because as you go up, you encounter some significantly cooler air, and you're going to have ice particles that come that are in the cloud. And then obviously if they get big enough, then they're going to fall. And probably what we saw yesterday in spots along with the hail was grapple, or those are just kind of the rimed ice where they're melted and then they refreeze again and then they hit the surface, but they don't have time to melt by the time they hit the ground. So we have all those processes in play, and I wouldn't be surprised if we see some hail and grapple out there today as well.
Okay. Thanks, Thomas. Hopefully I won't be on the golf course when that happens.
Hopefully not. Fingers crossed.
Have a good weekend.
You too.
Coming up, we're going to have an interview with UDOT representatives to talk about wildlife safety. It was recorded by Parker Malatesta. Then Bill Scirocco is going to join me in the studio to recap last night's city council meeting. And we're going to finish our hour with our monthly chat with Salt Lake Tribune executive editor Lauren Gustis. Stay tuned. The Summit County Council will meet with developer Dakota Pacific Real Estate behind closed doors after negotiating in public for almost 4 years. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports.
Dakota Pacific wants to build housing on roughly 50 empty acres it owns around the Skullcandy headquarters in western Kimball Junction. The company's current development agreement with Summit County says it can build tech offices, the equivalent of 24 more Skullcandies, there right now. During negotiations to amend the agreement for housing, Dakota Pacific CEO Mark Stanworth has repeatedly said he believes public meetings are not the right forum to get into the weeds of a development proposal. Now the Summit County Council agrees.
After relaying the county's most recent revised proposal, we've determined that it would be more effective to convene a subcommittee to work through the details of feasibility instead of doing that during the course of our normal meetings.
That's Council Chair Melina Stevens at the Council's April 24th meeting. The county's used subcommittees to get through the weeds of development proposals before, as with the Cedarcrest Village proposed in Hoytsville, which began in subcommittee and is now being evaluated in public at the Eastern Summit County Planning Commission. The Dakota Pacific Subcommittee would consist of council members Candace Hart and Chris Robinson, county staff, and members of the development company. With only two council members, the meetings won't have a quorum and therefore won't need to be public.
So we anticipate the group would meet over the course of a couple of months. And just to emphasize that no decisions or commitments will be made during these meetings, and the entirety of council, along with the public, will be presented with any ideas generated in this meeting in a public setting.
Stevens says the subcommittee will focus on a potential public-private partnership and land swap to see if they're economically possible. The parties have discussed trading the county's Sheldon Richens building for land directly west of Skullcandy. Council members have also asked Dakota Pacific to expand the Kimball Junction Transit Center and said a new county services building could go in beside Skullcandy. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Wasatch County Parks and Recreation has shut down its popular skate park after repeated acts of vandalism. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports police have some leads on possible suspects.
The skate park on 100 South has been a target for graffiti and vandalism before, but Parks and Recreation Assistant Director Heath Coleman says the problem has gotten worse lately.
The last year, 18 months, we've seen the major destruction, sinks and urinals and toilets being destroyed and crushed, all of our partitions ripped off the walls and bent and broke. We've had multiple fires in there.
He says drug use, fighting, and bullying have been recent issues at the park, too. The tipping point came last Friday when the park reopened its restrooms after another round of renovations. But within 24 hours, the bathrooms were vandalized again.
We arrived to close this facility down for until further notice because we're not going to put up with this anymore.
He says repairs and labor invested in the park are worth tens of thousands of dollars. Parks and Recreation is working with Heber City Police to find those responsible for the damage. They suspect it's mostly 12 to 16-year-old kids.
Within 2 hours of us closing that facility, some names came forward anonymously. There's quite a long list of names that Heber City PD has.
And Heber Police Sergeant Josh Weishar says the community is welcome to share additional tips with the department. But not everyone in the community agrees the response matches the problem. Creed Frenthaway has been biking at the park for years and says the skaters and riders aren't the ones causing trouble.
Usually kids that are at the skate park are working on progressing and, you know, challenging themselves and having fun. So I just think it's pretty unjust and unfair.
Frenthaway says he's always had positive experiences at the park.
I've been riding at that skate park ever since it was built, and it's always been a very healthy outlet for me growing up. It was like one of the very few things to do in this town.
He says he doesn't want to see that space taken away because of a few people's bad behavior. Coleman says Parks and Recreation doesn't want to keep the skate park closed forever. The department will host a community meeting May 1st to discuss their concerns and connect with residents. The meeting will begin at 7 p.m. in the Recreation Center on 600 South. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
The Park City Planning Commission unanimously moved to delay approving a new six-pack bubble lift at Deer Valley Resort at its meeting Wednesday. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports.
The proposed lift would pick up skiers at the confluence of the Ontario and Trump runs and travel to Park Peak, where Deer Valley plans to build a new lodge and gondola connection as part of its major terrain expansion. Six people spoke during a public hearing Wednesday, with two skiers speaking in support. Others criticized the proposal, citing concerns about skier traffic and the aesthetic beauty of Park Peak. Deer Valley Vice President of Mountain Operations Steve Graff said the new high elevation beginner terrain offered by the lift would ease congestion on the Ontario Run. Several planning commissioners requested that Deer Valley return to the next meeting with more information about how the resort plans to reduce the project's impact on wildlife. Commissioner Laura Susser also asked for more details about the lift's alignment in relation to the soon-to-be-built gondola, which will connect Park Peak to the new East Village base in Wasatch County. The item will return to the commission for a final vote at its May 8th meeting. Deer Valley is aiming to build 10 new lifts by winter 2025-26.
The lift under consideration by Park City officials Wednesday is the resort's only expansion lift outside Wasatch County, which approved plans for the 9 other lifts years ago. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
KPCW's Parker Malatesta talked with representatives from the Utah Department of Transportation about improving infrastructure for wildlife in Summit County and across the state. Here's that report.
I'm KPCW's Parker Malatesta. I'm here today with John Gleason. He's the Public Information Officer with the Utah Department of Transportation. I've also got with me Matt Howard. He's the Natural Resources Manager for UDOT. How's it going today, guys?
Going great. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Doing well.
Yeah, and you know, to start, I kind of wanted to zoom out. You know, John, I was kind of hoping you could touch overall what is UDOT's job? You know, what is most of the funding in UDOT's budget go towards?
Well, we have quite a few responsibilities from building new roads, maintaining the existing roads, and it's not just about roads. We're also looking at walking and biking trails and just looking at all modes of transportation, how to get people to where they're going. But we're also, in addition to building and maintaining roads and bridges and trails, we're also focused on safety as well. And we have our zero fatalities program where we get out into the schools early on and talk about the importance of safe driving behaviors for people. And, you know, I think, wildlife crossings that we've built recently and a lot of the wildlife mitigation that Matt and his team have been focused on from a UDOT perspective have all been focused on improving safety as well.
Yeah, Matt, I was hoping, could you touch specifically, you know, your job as natural resources manager, what does your role entail?
A big part of my job is making sure that UDOT is in compliance with all of the federal environmental laws like the Endangered Species Act, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act. So that's a big chunk of my job. And then also I have been able to leverage partnerships with Division of Wildlife Resources, which is where I came over from before I came to UDOT, to start working closely about from the public safety standpoint, making our roads safer, but also eliminating the barriers that some of these roads present for wildlife movement.
Yeah. Well, we wanted to talk specifically today about wildlife safety on State Route 224, which runs from Interstate 80 into Park City. It eventually turns into Park Avenue here in Park City. So there was a study a few years back that found that this road was the fifth worst road in Utah for vehicle wildlife collisions. And we've got a nonprofit here, Save People, Save Wildlife. They're very passionate about building more infrastructure for wildlife, specifically on State Route 224. I understand they came away a bit disappointed earlier this month when they found out UDOT wasn't going to go after the project they were looking or hoping to build there. John, could you kind of talk about, or Matt, just what kind of comes into that decision? What variables come into play when you guys are looking to get involved with a project like this?
Yeah, Matt, would you like to take this one?
Yeah, so we look at a bunch of different variables. We have collision data from our law enforcement partners. We also have carcass data where people who drive this corridor who are contracted by either Division of Wildlife or UDOT, they pick up carcasses, they have an app, they take a point every time they do. And then we also look at collar data from Division of Wildlife where they're tracking animals to see if these are areas where animals historically would have made long journeys, but they're no longer able to make that journey because of barriers like these roads. And then we rely very heavily on the institutional knowledge of the state biologists who know that area well. And so all of that kind of goes into our decision-making process when we're looking at what area warrants a crossing or fencing or escape ramps, that kind of thing. And then we also have to just face the realities of engineering feasibility, land ownership, and development possibility in the future. So there's just so many variables that go into each one of these areas.
And with you know, with the group Save People, Save Wildlife, we've worked with them over the years, and we understand and respect their passion for, you know, for wildlife safety and you know, just in their area. And you know, it's understandable. It's what they see every day. We have to take it from a statewide perspective and really determine the highest priority areas where there's a demonstrated problem that we can make a difference with if we take action.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask just more broadly, you know, John, when UDOT's looking at projects, you know, like you said, you know, it's not just Summit County. You're looking at St. George, you're looking at Logan, you're looking all over. What are kind of those primary factors when it comes to what gets top priority? I mean, is it just population and kind of those denser areas in the valley are always going to get higher priority, or are there other pieces in there that matter a lot too?
Matt, maybe,
I would say that high population areas probably are less likely to get this kind of thing because of the development that surrounds them. One of the things we're very concerned about or aware of is we don't want to be moving animals from one person's backyard to another. And so a lot of the areas where we put the emphasis on when we're identifying places for crossings are areas that are surrounded by high quality habitat that is connected for long distances in either direction. And so a lot of our crossings that we end up committing to or building are in less developed areas because that's where the highest quality habitat is and where the most robust herds of animals live.
Yeah, and I know, I believe it was 2018 that bridge over Parley Summit was finished. I kind of wanted to ask, you know, what pieces had to come together for such a big project like that to be completed?
So I would say the majority of crossings that have been built in Utah since we built the first one in North America have almost always been correlated with an existing UDOT project. And that's because of economies of scale. We already have the equipment out there. We have the personnel. We found that we can save 20 to 30% of the cost if we're able to coordinate a crossing with an existing project. And so there was a climbing lane in Parley Summit area that we coordinated with to put that structure in. Another thing that was a big factor in this area was it was our highest area of moose collisions. And it wasn't necessarily our highest deer collision area, but because just a few moose collisions can be catastrophic, that was one of the things that made it a good place. And one of the huge things there was that we already had the topography. We had these big hills on either side of the road. So all we needed to do in this case was to span that distance. And so the elevation part of building a crossing that was high enough to pass animals was already done for us.
And I think, Parker, speaking specifically about 224, you know, Matt touched on this, but, you know, working with our wildlife experts, the partners over at DWR, this is not a traditional migratory path for the animals. And so if we were able to build a crossing, essentially you'd just be transporting those animals into a neighborhood and they wouldn't have anywhere else to go. You know, because we've determined that a wildlife crossing would not you know, solve the issue or meet the goal in that area, but we are doing quite a bit of other, you know, taking other action here in terms of reducing the speed limit, putting in more signs to draw drivers' attention to the issue, and we're going to continue to look at other potential solutions as well, maybe even wildlife detection systems, more fencing. But you know, in looking at the Summit County area, there's an area not too far from here, several miles up the road at the Echo Junction, Echo Canyon area, 84 and I-80, where, you know, Matt and his team are applying for a grant. And we're very optimistic that we may be successful in that grant application, but it's a $30 million project that we're proposing that would address several of the existing wildlife crossings and add on a couple of additional wildlife crossings, as well as miles and miles of new fencing. And this is an area where we think that if we take action, we're going to be successful in reducing the number of vehicle wildlife collisions in this area.
Yeah, and that project in Echo, that would be an underpass or an overpass?
Currently, we have proposed two overpasses, potentially a third underpass, and then up to 7 or 8 existing crossings that we would fence to and potentially retrofit in small ways to create additional crossing points for animals. And that would be 21 total miles of fencing and infrastructure.
Yeah, well, you have to keep us updated on that. I'm about out of time. Are there any other points you two would like to make?
Well, I think just overall, I mean, reducing these type of crashes is a very high priority for us. No one wants to see animals hit or killed, and of course, you know, protecting people that are using our roads. That's got to be a primary focus here, and so we want to you know, stop these crashes from happening, and that's why we've made such a big effort across the state to put in crossings where they make sense and look at areas where we can put in fencing and just anything that we can do to reduce these type of crashes. That's our goal.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate it, Matt and John, you two taking the time to talk about this.
Thanks, Parker.
Thank you. Been speaking with Matt Howard and John Gleason from the Utah Department of Transportation.
In the studio with me this morning is Bill Sirocco, member of the City Council, to talk about last night's City Council meeting. Morning, Bill.
Morning, Roger.
Thanks for being here. So in the afternoon, as I understand it, Council held a work session on the budget. Employee compensation is obviously a major driver. One of the things I saw in the staff materials was this concept of a new philosophy to reflect the unique nature of Park City's job market. Can you explain what's going on?
Sure, Roger. Be happy to talk about that. So there's a process underway through our human resources lead to kind of modernize the way we think about our pay structure for employees. There was some simplification in terms of the way we apply pay. But also we needed to move past. We had a legacy situation where the city had arranged for some compensation to be withheld over the course of the year so that we could pay a bonus to employees at the end of the year. The city had brought that in, you know, years ago when employment, even at City Hall, was much more seasonal. And we would tend to lose people, you know, at the end of the winter, and we wanted to incentivize people to stay around all year long. You know, we're a full 365-day-a-year community now, so that need is kind of gone by the wayside. So we wanted to update and modernize that, and we also wanted to give ourselves some tools to make sure that we can maintain competitive, because we do have a high cost of living here in Park City, and it is difficult for us to retain and attract talent. So we had to acknowledge that. We have to pay people to reflect that, but we also wanted to add some focus on performance and rewarding people for performance, and that's where our new pay plan, that's the direction we move in.
When you look at the metrics of retention, obviously, as you just mentioned, this is a challenging environment. We talked to a lot of businesses who are struggling to maintain staffing. You're obviously trying to set compensation levels at a level that allows you to retain. How are you doing in terms of retention, and is there a target metric that you're looking for, and are you getting there?
So prior to my time on council, there was a compensation study done. I think we had Mercer Consulting come in and help us with that. They're the preeminent firm in that space. And that gave us some great insights as to where we needed to be competitively versus other municipalities here in Utah, because geographically that's who we compete against, but also versus other like towns in the Mountain West, because, you know, we do compete with Jackson Hole. We do compete with Aspen, with Telluride. So we needed to make sure that we stay relevant and we can attract the best talent. Look, we have some amazing things that are going to be happening in Park City over the next 10 years. We need to make sure we have the staff to help us execute on all those things and really reap the benefits.
budget discussions are always about priorities. Unlike the federal government, you can't necessarily run big deficits over a long period of time. So you've got to, you know, fit the round peg into the round hole. What are some hard decisions that you see having to be made with respect to prioritizing city projects?
Yeah, no, 100%. We actually can't run any deficits. So we're nothing like the federal government at all. We're fortunate here in Park City that we have this robust tourism economy that provides a huge stream of revenue into the city coffers. You know, I think it's somewhere close to 60% of the city budget is paid for from sales tax and tourism tax and transient room tax and all those sort of tourism-related taxes. And those numbers have been really good the past few years. I believe December and January this year, we were slightly below last year's numbers, but about where we had budgeted. February numbers this year came in well above last year's February, a record February we had for sales tax receipts. Now, that's the good news. I think, you know, if we kind of, if you want to play devil's advocate a little bit, there are some questions in the economy. There are some questions about whether the federal interest rate is going to cut interest rates this year, which was widely expected as recent as a month ago. And in the last month, you know, the rates market has moved the other way, and now they're expecting rates to stay higher and longer. And that gives me a little bit of concern about what happens to the economy and spending power. The longer we stay in a high rate environment, at some point we're going to have to pay the piper. So right now we're in good shape financially. The city's, you know, revenues are great. But I think as we move through this year's budgeting process and start thinking about next year at some point, you know, after July 1, I think the conversation needs to focus on, let's make sure what we're doing is sustainable through any sort of economic environment.
So on the spending side, obviously you have to go through and look at different projects. What I really want to get at is, where do you think the hard decisions are going to be in terms of what gets spent on and what doesn't, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, look, I think the largest component of our budget is our staffing costs. Mm-hmm. And that's not just salaries, but that's benefits, health, retirement, and all the related costs that go into that. I think, you know, not this meeting, but 2 weeks ago or 2 or 3 weeks ago at our meeting, we talked about giving the city manager, the reins to really think about our organizational structure to make sure that we're spending money wisely. So I think over the coming months, we'll hear more on that. I know we're all excited to make sure that we're well prepared for what we have in front of us. But to me, that's the biggest area of that's really where we have to focus on.
I know one area that came up yet last night where there was some vibrant public input involved a crosswalk across Kearns Boulevard. Can you talk a little bit about the context of what that was? Where would that be, and what was the discussion like?
Sure. So basically, it was a presentation from our chief engineer, John Robertson, on Snow Creek Tunnel, which has been a project that has been talked about for, I think originally out of the walkability committee from, 10 plus years ago, where there was a thought that we need a crossing over by Kearns Boulevard between, call it the DoubleTree property and Snow Creek Plaza. Unfortunately, the solution that was identified, a tunnel, the costs for that have ballooned dramatically, from 10 years ago and even in as little as the last 2 years, from about $13 million to about $18.5 million total cost for that tunnel. So that begs the question, is that the right investment to make there? During the presentation last night, City Engineer John Robinson stated that the data currently does not support a crossing at that location. And look, data doesn't measurement of data doesn't take into account near misses. Like we don't see that. So there, I've had a near miss there myself. So we're not saying that there isn't some, concern in that area, but there's no data to support making that investment. We applied for a grant for that project. It did not qualify for the grant because the data didn't support it. So the question is, what can we do in the interim to make that location safer? So we steered the conversation to an at-grade crossing. What would that look like? A crosswalk, with activated signage or a hawk signal. And a hawk signal is what we have out in front of the Fresh Market where the bus stop is. So when a pedestrian needs to cross the street, they press the button and we get a red light. You know, so, and there was talk about concerns of what that does to traffic in that area. You know, so we, council's decision last night was, let's understand what the traffic counts are there. So that requires a traffic study. And that's a very small investment, $15,000, $20,000, you know, and in the context of looking at an $18.5 million investment, I think that's the way to go.
I guess to put, can we put $18.5 million as a capital investment into context? That seems like an enormous amount relative to other projects that you're looking at.
Yeah, and, you know, I tried to do that a little bit last night because I've used the tunnels on Kearns Boulevard. I had my daughter use the tunnel by the high school and picked her up on Cook Drive side. I've used the Comstock Tunnel because when I bike, when I want to access the rail trail from the western part of town, west of 224, I'll usually bike through Park Meadows and then cut through the junior high and get over to the rail trail over there. But I see people all the time, you know, on bikes, at the crosswalk, pressing the button, waiting to cross. Skiers, when they get dropped off at the end of the day, when they're parked in the high school parking lot, they don't use that high school tunnel. They use the crosswalk. So the question is, $18.5 million, are we going to get the kind of usage out of that? Yes, it would be an improvement, but is the juice worth the squeeze?
You received an update on the Bonanza Park project timeline. I read the staff report and I found it a little bit confusing, particularly the prolonged discussion of the difference between RFPs and proposals indicating qualifications. In plain English, Bill, what is the timeline for this project and how are you going to get it moved along?
Well, I think last night one of the takeaways is that from the meeting 2 or 3 weeks prior, we have shaved the timeline by 4 or 5 months, from approximately 15 months down to about 10 months or so. We still want to move faster. And that really was the conversation last night. We directed staff. We said, look, what do you need from us as a council to move this process faster? We want to set a goal in terms of timing, right? And goals are great because it's something that you can measure against. And, you know, if we set a goal and it's aggressive and we miss the goal by a month or two, we're still going to be way ahead of where we were had we not set the goal.
They tend to focus the mind. So in terms of the process,
yeah.
Okay, are we looking at trying to, it looked to me as though the current process is to develop the RFP eventually that would actually create a proposal to actually do the work. In other words, it's a big two-step.
Yep.
So we're looking at, you know, a period of months before we can even go out the door with a detailed proposal. Who would you be asking for to get a detailed proposal?
So we talked about this last night. And so there are two processes that are running simultaneously here. First, we have an RSOQ. Right. Which is basically a request for qualifications. So we basically want to go out to market and we want to identify firms that have done this kind of work and have done it well. And that gives us a chance to create a subset of vendors who will then bid on the RFP process. What that also does is it allows those vendors to get some familiarity with the project, which makes their RFP response timeline probably a little bit shorter because they're more familiar, right? They're not getting it out of the blue. So the RSOQ, I think we're talking about a end of May timeframe for that to get out there. And then, you know, last night staff communicated that they should be ready with the RFP to go to market with that end of August, early September. We're pushing to have that fall a little bit earlier in August if we can. And there's a couple reasons. You know, if we release it the last week of August, no one's probably going to look at it for a week at least. And then also at the end of July, there's a potential for a very large announcement that will shine a lot of attention on Park City. And, you know, from a practical standpoint, if I were running, a planning firm, a development firm somewhere in the country, you know, and I understood that Park City was now going to be, you know, co-host of the 2034 Olympics, and there was an opportunity to do work there, that might be really appealing.
So the proposal, what you will be asking, when the proposal goes out the door,
yeah.
What exactly will you be asking these firms to do?
So the RFP, you know, that's for now, I'll say TBD.
Right.
Right. But we're basically, we want to create the most streamlined, information packed RFP that allows us to get responses from the marketplace, which will include designs, pro forma, so we understand what the economics are, things that we haven't thought about, right? So we're, you know, hopefully we get a response from vendors in the planning marketplace who are really, really skilled and really creative.
So what we'll get is a detailed plan.
Correct.
That will then allow you to take the next steps toward building what I understand to be a public-private partnership to actually develop the area.
100%. And so at the conclusion of the RFP process, the city will select the vendor out of that RFP process. And at that point, you know, that gives us a streamlined path to moving forward with the planning process, right? So there'll have to be an application will have to be submitted. We'll have to go through planning commission. And then the council will focus on what we can do with that process to get us moving as quickly as possible. You know, I know that myself and at least a few of the other council members, and I won't speak for anyone else, but I know myself, we're hoping that we can get a shovel in the ground before the 2025 construction season ends.
And as we've said before, it's good to have in your mind, at least, and not on paper, a deadline, or, you know, a goal.
Yeah.
A goal. Last week, Sundance announced that it will be considering its options. Quickly before we go, what is your take? There are obviously emotional and artistic considerations about the value of Sundance to the town. How should the city go about evaluating the economics of Sundance?
Yeah, look, Roger, I'll share with you. I've got a pretty special and kind of unique view on Sundance. I have a cousin who is a screenwriter. We tried to develop his first independent film back in 2000-2001 timeframe. September 11th kind of sidetracked that process. But you know, from New York City, Ed Burns, 1995, was one of the big Sundance success stories. That's someone who I know and I've played softball with back east. So I've known about Sundance for 30 plus years. I think it's a great asset for the community. But at the same time, you know, I would argue that Park City is a great asset for Sundance, right? We both grew up together, and we both represent, you know, kind of the best of what we do. So I think there's a huge potential for us to continue that partnership. I hope the folks at Sundance, understand that. We understand there's some economic challenges. The city is open to doing, what we can to help them with that, but I think it's going to require some cooperation from the state government as well as, the Salt Lake City, Salt Lake County area as well.
I suspect we'll be talking more about that in weeks to come. Bill, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks, Roger.
We'll be right back after this. Lauren Gustis, the executive editor of the Salt Lake Tribune, is on the phone with us for our monthly chat. Good morning, Lauren.
Hi, Roger. How are you?
Lauren, the airwaves, particularly during the local news, it seems, are filled with campaign ads for Mitt Romney's now open Senate seat. What's going on in that race, and is it strange that all these ads seem to be paid for by PACs?
Yeah, Roger, thanks. So we've got the statewide nominating conventions this weekend. So tomorrow, both Democrats and Republicans will meet to nominate their slate of candidates for statewide offices, including Mitt Romney's seat, including Attorney General, including for Governor of Utah. And some of the folks who will be at those conventions, if you recall, Utah's got a slightly dual track system, if you will. Not slightly, it does have a dual track system in that you can either collect signatures to put yourself on the ballot, or you can be picked as your nominee of your party if you're in the Republican Party on Saturday. And so Spencer Cox is in for governor, right? He's collected signatures. He paid a lot of money, about $147,000, to make sure that he made the ballot. So there are others who will be vying for the nomination, quote unquote, of the Republican Party tomorrow. And then, you know, same with AG and same with Mitt Romney's Senate seat and some of the House seats that are open that are we're seeing re-election bids in. And so all of that will be determined on Saturday. Saturday is a moment of clarity or clarifying moment, if you will, in terms of how the money is being spent. Yeah, it's been really interesting. We reported on Phil Lyman, who is challenging Governor Spencer Cox for the governor's seat here in Utah, and his campaign fundraising efforts this week. And it's really interesting, hard to track. You know, there are entities that have been set up that are accepting, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars on behalf of Phil Lyman. The Government Leadership Solutions entity, which was registered with the state of Utah the same day that the candidate's filing period closed in January, you know, 3 days later, you know, they made a $100,000 donation to Lyman. There are connections. Lyman acknowledged in our reporting this week that some of his family members are connected to this entity. And he essentially said, like, I'd like to not get beat up by Spencer Cox's people, and I don't want people to know where my money is coming from. So, there's a lot of ways to get around, I would say, transparent campaign finance in Utah, and candidates are using those mechanisms.
For those of us who are like trying to track this, you just mentioned that it's a hybrid process. Let's talk for a minute, again, focusing on the Senate seat. We have people who are collecting signatures. We have a convention. How will that get determined? Do you have to hit a certain threshold at the convention to lock up the nomination? How does it work?
Yeah, 10 Republicans are vying for the nomination, the party's nomination to replace Mitt Romney, right? So as of yesterday morning, three had already secured a spot in the primary. That's Brad Wilson, John Curtis, and Jason Walton. The GOP delegates will determine if there's anyone else in the race. So 4,000 delegates who are gathering at the Salt Palace on Saturday morning will make that determination. So after Saturday morning's vote, we should have clarity on who is in the GOP race to replace Mitt Romney.
So there will be a primary. It's just a question of the delegates could add more candidates
Precisely.
To that primary line.
Wow. You got it.
Okay. Yeah. Anything going on of any drama on the Democratic side at all?
Nope. we've got three Democrats in the race, and they are also meeting tomorrow morning. I think they're in Cottonwood. One of them is probably fairly well known to your folks. That's Caroline Gleick. She is the Mountaineer from up your way. Laird Hamblin and Archie Williams are challenging her, and one candidate will emerge out of the Democratic primary process caucuses tomorrow. So we'll have one Democrat, and then we'll have, a whole bunch of Republicans. So the Democratic primary will be drama-free because you'll only have one option if you're voting Democrat in the primary a little later this spring, summer.
Let's talk a little bit about, let's move from one kind of contact sport to another. I want to talk a little bit about hockey. The arrival of the NHL, it's created a lot of excitement. First question is, how will the team, which is kind of like Prince at the moment, a team whose name will be named later, how will that get decided?
Roger, that's a great comparison. Thank you for making that. I was downtown when they did the big party earlier this week on Wednesday afternoon, and there were people lined up for literally blocks to get into the Delta Center to participate in this first celebration. And they had all kinds of hockey team shirt on. I saw like Blackhawks, Bruins, you name it, right? And so I think anyone who likes hockey is excited about this Utah team. And I'm sure that they will adopt this Utah team as their team. But Ryan Smith has said it'll be a bracket challenge. So we'll move through any number of rounds of voting to get to the name of our team. We're not in a rush. So the first season for this team will be called Utah, and we'll go from there. That's the process, I understand it.
Are they going to put something on a website where this is more complicated than the Republican nominating process?
I think the effort here, at least if I'm to be a cynical journalist, is let's get as much publicity for this as we can, and we'll draw it out as long as we can. And we'll show people a whole bunch of options for multiple rounds to keep the drama and the excitement high for this team.
And the excitement really was pretty high. I mean, there was nothing really to see. And what did they draw, like 12,000 people on
They did. They filled Delta to capacity. They couldn't let any more people in. 11,000 people have already signed up for season tickets. So there's a ton of excitement. And I think there was a lot of skepticism. There probably still is around how much Utahns will support hockey. But the early signs are super promising.
And, you know, I was thinking about this. The economic significance of 41 home games for downtown Salt Lake City has got to be substantial.
Yeah, we're working on that. I mean, you've got teams coming in, right? Ryan has said what he wants to build downtown, this entertainment center, right, will transcend hockey. And he'll use some of the money that he will get, the essentially the district will get from a 5.5% sales tax increase in the city of Salt Lake. It might be the county. Sorry, I should check on that. But anyways, it's a 0.5% to build out, you know, a larger area. He wants the players to live downtown. He wants people to access this space beyond those 41 home games. And obviously, that's in addition to all the games that the Jazz are already playing at Delta and concerts that come in and so on and so forth. So I would expect Delta will be fairly packed and there will be people downtown, you know, on more nights of the year than there aren't.
Yeah, and so they're not talking about, they will still play in Delta. He's not talking about building another ice rink, is he?
There was talk about that, and it seems at this point to be less likely than it was in the past. So the commitment as it stands these days is to retrofit Delta so that you can fit both hockey and basketball in there.
You had a front page story on some expensive trips taken by the Vineyard City staff. One of the things that's really important about local journalism is the way it holds a local government to account. Talk to us a little bit about what your reporters uncovered.
Yeah, this is an interesting story. There is a new mayor in the city town, Vineyard. It's if those of you who are listening don't know where it is, it's right on Utah Lake. It's a relatively new city. It's about 14,000 people. And just before the council headed out last year, a lame duck council headed out, they made a bunch of, you know, moves, including to approve a heck of a lot of money for a couple of trade associations that seem to have very little to do with what Vineyard City is doing, including the World Trade Organization and Aerospace Organization. And these associations' dues, for example, World Trade Organization is $50,000 over the course of 3 years, $150,000 over the course of 3 years, $50,000 per year, right? And what that enabled the mayor to do is to go on, you know, trips supposedly to promote Vineyard City, but she's gone to Paris, she's gone to London, she's gone to Ukraine, she's gone to India, and she's taken staffers with her. And we reported after doing open records or grandma requests, you know, that the city has spent $188,500 on trade missions and the membership in these groups since 2023. Remember, we're only in 2024. And if you do the math on that, that's about $12 per taxpayer, right? We're not sure what the ROI is. You know, maybe it will come to pass in future deals that are made such that Vineyard City attracts business from Paris or London. But, you know, the comings and goings of all public officials, like you said, who they meet with, when they meet with them, on whose dime, I feel like are crucial information. And so I'm glad we brought this to the fore. And I know it's been a topic of discussion in Vineyard City post-publication.
Have there been any response from the city as to, you know, why they thought these expenditures were justified?
They did offer good response in that they engaged with us. They mm-hmm. had, you know, a good dialogue, and I'd encourage you to find the story if you're interested in reading more. Okay. It's at sltrib.com. You know, it would be up to the reader to determine, you know,
okay. Fair enough. But they did
the quality
respond.
Of those responses. Yeah, they did. They did.
You ran a front page story earlier this week on where women are and are not making progress in Utah. Real quickly, can you sort of share the highlights of that so that if our listeners are interested, they can learn more?
Yeah, so this year marked the 10th anniversary of the Women's Leadership Project, which is an organization. It's run by a woman named Pat Jones, who has a long history here in Utah of trying to engage women in leadership. And the idea here is, how do we get more women to run for public office, to take leadership positions? And we've made a little bit of progress there. We've got 25 lawmakers in Utah now who are female versus, I think it was 15 when the Women's Leadership Institute started 10 years ago. But where we're backsliding is in women in CEO positions. Women who serve on corporate boards and CEOs in Utah has decreased. Both of those numbers have between 2024 and 2018 and 2024. I did that backwards.
Before we go, Kevin Bacon came back to Payson last week. He ran some stories on that. Why did he come back, and what was it like?
he came back for Payson's prom. So Payson was the scene of the original Footloose movie, which we, I think, all love. And if you don't, then let's talk. I'm kidding. And the students there had, like, lobbied him to come back because the school is going to be razed. It's going to be torn down and, you know, they're going to build a new school. And so they really wanted to see if they could get him to come back for the 40th anniversary of the movie, which just so happened to coincide with the school being demoed. And he did. And it sounds like it was a great day for all who got to hang out with Kevin Bacon. And they did a lot of good. They did some volunteer work, some nonprofit work while he was down.
Well, it seems like demolishing the school is rather an extreme step to keep them from holding a dance. But at any rate, Laura Augustus, thanks for joining us here.
Have a great weekend, Roger.
We'll be right back after this.